Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. As we live longer lives, people rarely contemplate the emotional changes that come alongside the physical changes of aging. Madeline Cunin would like to change that. The former three-term governor of Vermont also served as Deputy Secretary of Education and Ambassador to Switzerland under President Clinton. Her memoir is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. Madeline Cunin joins us from her studio at WGBH in Boston. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
The book begins with this paragraph. As I adjust to old age, I feel like Jan is looking in two directions at once, surveying my lengthy past and examining my foreshortened future. Death's black raven perches on my shoulder from time to time. Even when he flies away, I know he's in the neighborhood. So you liken this to living sort of in two dimensions.
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, you have more time to think about the past. And you can still dream about the future, but you know the future is shorter than it used to be.
So the first chapter, The Year I Turned 80, you talk about the role the color red played in your life.
Yes. Somehow I wanted bright red, and I bought a red Prius, and I have a chapter about buying two big red chairs. I wanted something vibrant, alive, and attractive.
Yeah. And you say that you might have gone for a convertible if you weren't worried about it.
Right.
Messing your hair and your hearing and
right.
All of that. So the red convertible, the red Prius and the red chairs, this was as you were and your husband were moving into Wake Robin assisted living and smaller condo, kind of downsizing. Was that sort of your way of saying, you know, I'm not going out without a fight?
Well, it sort of seemed a practical decision to move to a more limited space and where my husband could get care or I could get care if I needed it. So it was a big move because we had to make big changes. But in the end, we were very happy to be there, and I'm still there. My husband died just about a year ago now, and so it's a safe space, and it's also a gift to your children so that if you do need more help, you can get it, and your children don't have to worry about you.
So one of the surprises for me was your poetry that appears between chapters. When did you first begin writing poems?
Well, I guess I wrote poems off and on, but not steadily for a long time. But in the last 5 or 6 years, I started to write seriously. And I still didn't think I was a poet till somebody called me one. So I have a new title of poet and writer. And it's a new phase of my life, because when you're in public life, when you hold office, you have to be careful. You have to screen your words through a sieve so as not to offend or not to get into trouble. But in my 80s, I felt, what the heck, I could say what I want, I could dress as I want, I didn't have to be so careful about the right color suit or what kind of a blouse. I didn't have to be gubernatorial. And so it was kind of a liberating phase of my life where I felt free to be introspective. I mean, you can't write poetry when you, at least I can't, when you're in office where your schedule changes every 15 minutes. You have to have quiet time and thinking time.
Yeah, that's funny you brought up the part about the suit, because that's a section I took out here where you write, when I entered politics, my staff received a phone call in the middle of a gubernatorial campaign. Tell her not to wear gray stockings, and I knew I had to stick to my uniform. Neutral stockings, small-heeled shoes, a dark suit, a sensible blouse with no cleavage, and for variety, I could add a bright scarf. The message was, don't stand out. I was on a teeter-totter, not too feminine and not too masculine, just enough of each gender to look like a real governor, male, and still be true to myself, female. You think that's changed?
I think it is changing, certainly with the new crop of women, congresswomen that got elected in this past election. They're much more flamboyant. They're much more ready to express themselves through what they wear. But I think it's still there to some extent, because voters kind of look at this woman politician and say what she's like, what is she, who is she, and clothes do sort of send a message. But I think it's pretty easy for legislative positions that there's not so much gender stuff going on. But for executive positions like governor and, of course, president, it's still out there. Women running for president get so carefully scrutinized that every inch of clothing is has a meaning or people interpret. So it's better than it used to be, but it's still a much harder job for women to dress what we consider appropriately than for men. All they have to do, the men have to do, is put on a navy blue suit and perhaps a red tie or a pink tie, and that's the outfit, that's the model that is in our heads. Yeah. So women have to be both masculine enough to be tough, to be commander-in-chief, but feminine enough to be authentic. And that's the real key. How do you present yourself as authentic, that you are who you appear to be?
Yeah. I want to go back to your poetry and wonder if you would read the poem No Longer. This is the poem that begins that chapter of the year I turned 80.
Okay, I'd be happy to do that. No longer. No longer will we make love before breakfast. No longer will I dream of seeing New Zealand or the Cape of Good Hope or bears in the wild. No longer will I say yes more than no. No longer will danger sparkle and safety look dull. No longer will I look at my body without comparison between who I was and who I have become, blaming the light for the difference. No longer can I toss my hair over my face and count 100 strokes. No longer can I do without night cream and day cream, slathering on ounce after ounce. No longer can I be comfortable sitting in my chair reading for hours without getting up to stretch my arms and legs. No longer can I walk without looking down at my feet to avoid mean cracks and malicious bumps. No longer can I skip downstairs like a girl flying without feeling a thing. No longer can I approach the precipice without swaying against my will. No longer do I think ahead of where I will be in 10 years or 20 or more. Now I think in ones or twos or threes, long enough to still hunger for the food of life. No longer do I wish for the next day or the next year to come quickly, like I did the year I turned 10. I want the days to saunter like a leisurely museum stroller who stops now and then to gaze and get closer to the canvas to see the brushstrokes, and then steps back for the long view before moving on.
I have to say, I loved the poetry in the book. It's very honest and personal, as is the whole book, I feel. And it shows this different side of you, I think, than a lot of people have seen. And I should mention, I was a reporter in Vermont when you were governor. And so I had this vision of you as governor, and to kind of get this glimpse into the more personal thoughts of your life was really quite lovely. And you declare in the book, I am not old. And it reminds me of a Satchel Paige quote, "How old would you be if you didn't know how old you were?"
That's a good line. Yeah.
Yeah. So you were the first woman to have been elected governor for 3 terms in Vermont. What were the pressures you felt being the first woman?
Well, I felt I had to kind of set a good example, being the first in Vermont and the fourth elected in my own right in the country. You know, if I failed, it might mark all the other women who might run in the future. So there was that kind of pressure to set a good example. The other pressure was to try to please everybody. And I think women, even more than men, feel they have to please. And certainly the our present president doesn't feel that pressure, but that's in the extreme. But the recognition that you can't, that you do have to say no and live with the consequences, and that your constituents aren't all of one mind. Even, you know, people think, well, why don't you just listen to the people and behave in that direction? And, of course, the people aren't unified.
Right.
So you have to make some tough decisions and stick by them.
You also had another pressure. Your older brother, Edgar May, a Pulitzer Prize winner, was in the legislature, chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee when you were governor. Talk about your relationship with your brother.
Well, my brother and I were very close. We lost our father at a very young age. I was 2 and a half. And so he became both the older brother and, in a sense, a father figure. So he influenced me a great deal. And on the whole, we were on the same page. We had the same values. We talked about the same things. But when we differed, which happened once in a while, people noticed. And when the roll call was called, which is alphabetical, and his name was Edgar May, which came after Cunin. And one day he got so upset when somebody said, oh, you're voting with your sister again. That didn't sit well with Edgar. So he asked the clerk to call the roll backwards. And that flummoxed everybody. They didn't know when their turn came or how to vote. So that was a one-time thing. But yeah, it was interesting. Let's put it that way.
Of course, there's always sibling rivalry, right? But he was very proud of you when you became governor.
Yes, he was. He was. And we were two immigrant children. My mother brought us to America at the dawn of World War II in 1940. And little did we think that both of us would end in politics and that he would become a famous writer. So as a consequence, I still strongly believe in the American dream, though it's harder to realize than it was for us coming from Europe. But my mother used to say to us, anything is possible in America, and we believed her.
Yeah. We're talking with Madeline Cunin. Her memoir is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Madeline Cunin, former three-term governor of Vermont. She also served as deputy secretary of education and ambassador to Switzerland under President Bill Clinton. Her new book is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. When you went to Washington as deputy secretary of education, you were at that time were separated from your first husband. And you talk in the book about sort of a loneliness, isolation that women in power feel. But there you found other women like you.
Yes. You know, Washington is full of, or at least it used to be, and I presume some of this still holds, is full of women who have developed careers and are in leadership positions. And so it's a good place to make friends just socialize with women. Of course, there are men there too, but they're harder to find.
Yeah. You write here, I had dated several men in Washington, but no one seriously. I'd begun to feel that a powerful woman sets off a flashing yellow light to prospective male companions. Caution, she may be too much for you.
Well, that's true. I think Madeleine Albright once talked about that or wrote about that. Yeah, we sort of send off a signal that scares some people. Luckily, my second husband, John Hennessy, wasn't scared, and that was one of his attributes. In addition to meeting two strong criteria of mine, he was a Democrat and a feminist. So what more could I ask for?
And I'm going to get to him in a minute, but I also want to talk about this loneliness thing, because when you became ambassador to Switzerland, your social life was very different than what you had in Washington. Talk about what that was like.
Well, it was a little more isolating, especially at first. I was invited to dinner parties and events, but as a single woman, and I was invited places because I was ambassador, and people want to know who the American ambassador was in Switzerland. But I couldn't reach out in the same way I could in Washington, but eventually I did make some friends and people I could go to a movie with. I mean, that's something basic. And I made some good friends who I still keep in touch with. Mm. But they were a very small group and very important to me.
Yeah. So when you became ambassador, you changed the decor, if you will. And one of the things that's important to you are books. And you lined your bookshelves in your office. What was the message you were trying to send?
Well, a couple of messages. One, I loved to be with books. It was important to me. When I walked into the residence, there were these musty, leather-bound, beginning to fray books, which obviously nobody had opened in at least 100 years. And I brought some of my books with me to the residence. And I wanted the familiar authors and titles. And I also wanted to demonstrate what American literature was like. And I thought this would be sort of soft diplomacy. But as it turned out, as I wrote, nobody actually paid attention. I did. But nobody stopped and say, oh, how interesting that you're reading Thomas Wolfe or whoever it may have been they stumbled upon.
During your tenure as ambassador, aging Holocaust survivors were pressuring the United States to take action to help them recover funds that had been stored in Swiss banks during World War II. And you write, did Bill Clinton appoint you to be the ambassador because you're Jewish? I was asked. Of course not. He probably doesn't even know, I replied. Later you write, I felt deep responsibility. I carried it daily as I praised the Swiss parliamentarians for inaugurating a study of Switzerland's role during World War II and criticized the banks for stonewalling. I played good cop, bad cop. It took a toll on me emotionally when I had to control my frustration, even anger. There were few outlets. Talk about that a little bit more.
Well, it was a challenging position to be with. First of all, my religion had never played a role before I became ambassador. As I said, most people didn't think about being Jewish or Catholic or whatever, and it wasn't an issue. But in Switzerland, partly because of the focus on the role of Switzerland during World War II, it was present. Sometimes in the newspaper, I would be described as the Jewish American ambassador. And I didn't really want to get used to the idea, but it was just their way of doing things. And the whole question of Switzerland's role during World War II occupied me almost every day that I was ambassador. It was a real challenge. And then I felt some responsibility to try to help solve the problem. It focused on bank accounts. Jewish families deposited their savings in Swiss bank accounts because they were secret and numbered. And after the war, those who survived tried to get their money back, and the heirs of those who were killed tried, and they were stonewalled by the banks and by the government. So I felt I had to do something, and it almost became symbolic of the Holocaust. I mean, that the survivors or the heirs really had a right to get their funds back, and they had to have the power to get their funds back. So I played a role in that. Others did too. But in the end, a judge in New York, of all things, worked with the banks and got a compromise agreement that the money was given back for the most part. Of course, you can't retrace all those steps.
Right.
And then they had a list in the newspapers of what they call dormant account holders. And one morning I woke up to read the paper and found my mother's name on the list.
And that was surprising to you because you thought, well, surely they could have tracked her down.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Now, so you were born in Zurich in 1933. You were 6 and your brother 10 when your mother decided to head to America to escape the threat of Hitler's invasion. What do you remember? Do you remember anything about that?
Well, for me, it was an adventure at that age. I remember playing shuffleboard, which isn't a major activity during a time of crisis, but I was a child. And I remember we were all astounded by apple pie a la mode, or even with cheese. I mean, that seemed very bizarre. And I just saw it as an adventure. I wasn't afraid. I wasn't aware of the danger. At one point, there was a belief that we were vulnerable to submarine attack. But it was called the SS Manhattan. And when we arrived in New York at the harbor, my cousin and his wife met us, Irene, and the first thing she said to me, she had a red purse and a red hat and red shoes, quite amazing. And she said, "Mudlin, you got to have coils. All the girls in America have coils." So she was adapted to a great Brooklyn accent. And I turned to my mother and I said, "Of course, I want curls."
All right, let's talk to Denise, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning. I am so glad to hear Governor Coonan's voice and to have especially heard that wonderful poem. First, I want to say that my sister-in-law was a dear friend of yours, Priscilla Welsh.
Oh, yes.
And just hearing your voice just reminds me of wonderful times in Burlington and your wonderful poems and the friendship that she had with you. And I just, as a family representative, I wanted to say welcome to Woods Hole.
Well, thank you.
The poem you read was just the conversations that I was having with early morning friends who are between 70 and 80, well into their 80s. And the whole business of not being able to leap from rock to rock or saying, "I'll just run upstairs," and knowing that we don't run upstairs anymore, it was a perfect way to start this morning. And I wanted to thank you very much for it.
Thank you so much. And Priscilla was a great friend, a wonderful friend. So I'm thrilled to talk to you.
Denise, thanks for the phone call.
Wonderful sister-in-law, too.
All right. Thank you, Denise. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And hang on, Denise, because I know she's going to read another poem or two for us in a few minutes. I wanted to get back to leaving. You in the book, you said, you know, how did your mother, you know, decide what to leave in the Zurich apartment and what to pack for America? And, you know, the things she brought became very, very important.
Right. I just suddenly tried to put myself in her shoes. I mean, I didn't fully appreciate her courage and determination when I was a child. But, you know, for a woman alone with two young children to come to America, she had a limited knowledge of English. I mean, she had to be really brave to do that. I remember that when we left the Zurich railroad station, everybody gave us chocolate, and I was responsible to hold on to the bag of chocolates, and I lost them. So I felt very chagrined. But my mother had this idealistic view of America, and most of it turned out to be true, but it was not easy for a woman alone then, as it is not easy now. And we weren't poor, though I grew up in what today is called a single-parent household, but we weren't well off either. So she was very careful with money, and there were things I couldn't do that I wanted to do. But on the whole, she brought both me and my brother up in a loving way. That's what mattered.
Hmm. Now, what did you learn about your father in this process? You mentioned you were just two when he died.
Unfortunately, I don't remember him at all, and I wish I did. There are photographs that I sometimes stare at and try to withdraw something from the picture. You know, what kind of a person was he? And my mother, of course, talked about him not as much as I would have liked, but because he had a tragic ending. He was depressed, and now, as I think about it, he was drafted into the German army in World War I, and I think he must have suffered from PTSD, and he committed suicide when I was 2 and a half. So, you know, partly I wrote this book to create a more full picture of who I am. Because when you're in politics, everything is one-dimensional. You know, you're either Democrat or Republican, you're good or you're bad, you're believable or not. But, of course, every life has many nuances in between the one-dimensional criteria. So who I am was also shaped by my father, even though he wasn't alive. And another influence, of course, was the Holocaust itself. Mm-hmm. So I wanted just to explain to people, this is my life. It's not complete, of course. It never is. It's an ongoing process. But it was satisfying to try to fill in the blanks. Mm.
And although you're not a Holocaust survivor, do you have Holocaust survivor's guilt?
Just somewhat, yes. I wrote that in the book. I feel, in a way, it's my responsibility to remember those who died. I have an aunt and uncle who were killed. I have cousins who fled for other places, but on both the French and the German side. My mother's family was French. My father's was German. And I want to keep their memory alive. And I also realize that I'm in a position as an immigrant in the United States of America to be in public life, to be outspoken about what I believe in. And that is a privilege, of course, those who lived and died in the Holocaust could never have. So I feel I must use the opportunity that was given to me.
Mm. You were 71 when you fell in love with John. Tell us about that meeting, how you met John, and how that romance blossomed.
Well, it was really a wonderful romance, and I knew him from a distance for a while. When I was governor, when I was running for governor, these checks came from Hanover, New Hampshire, from a John Hennessy, and I didn't know who this was. And then after I completed my terms of office, I had an appointment at Dartmouth College and for called a Montgomery Fellow, and I sought out John Hennessy and then for advice for an ethics commission, which actually happened while I was governor. So we knew each other as personages. That after his wife died, he had formed an organization, Americans for Campaign Reform, with some other people. And we met each other again. And when we met each other for lunch, and I happened to have 2 tickets for the Vermont Symphony Orchestra that night. And he was very skeptical about the coincidence of this, but in a jocular way. And I asked if he wanted to go to the symphony with me. And he said, "What's the program?" And I said, "Beethoven's Ninth." And I guess I have to thank Beethoven.
Because he did like Beethoven's
Yes. Night.
No, and I think somewhere in the book, right, he said something when you were to get married, something like, I've got maybe 10 years I can give you. He was a little bit older than you were.
Yes, he was 9 years older than me. Yeah. And yeah, at that time, that seemed like forever. I guess when you're in love, you're not necessarily realistic. Mm-hmm. And but he was pretty accurate. It was about 10 or 11 years that he was well. And we just were very compatible, which is kind of a soft word. We got along famously and had so much in common.
And his health started to deteriorate, and he became more prone to losing his balance. And you write, a fall I fear could kill him. My arm was in a constant state of readiness. A low level of his anxiety permeated out a partnership. If he fell when I was with him, it would be my fault, only more so. I found myself as an old woman, reliving the tension I'd experienced as a young woman. Should I give myself to the children, or should I venture out to my own life? We were fortunate to be at Wake Robin, where help was always available. How terrible I had felt when I did not get home from giving a speech in time to watch my son blow out his 9 birthday candles. I should have been there when I was elsewhere. Now the same dilemma haunted me. Should I go to my office and write? Have lunch with friends, feed my own soul, bad mother, neglectful wife, selfish woman. But these were not John's thoughts. These were your thoughts.
Right. And I think many women can identify with that. I mean, you go through waves of guilt about where you should be and where your time is most necessary. I think a lot of women experience that more or less. Everybody is different in how they handle it. But yeah, it was not exactly a repeat, but because I think it was much tougher as a young mother trying to be both a good mother and wife and be good at a job or career. So yeah, it just struck me as a bizarre kind of coincidence. But you get over it and move on.
I wonder if you would read your poem, I Loved When You Did the Dishes.
Okay. I just have to...
Just find it.
Here we go. I loved you when you did the dishes. I cooked. You did the dishes. Did I love you for that? I listened to the distant clattering in the kitchen while I sat in my chair reading the newspaper. We shared most things then, but you did the driving, and I could sit still by your side with only a rare glance in the rearview mirror to check if it was safe to pass. Now I do everything, cook and wash the pots and meet the dishwasher's greedy demands. I make the bed which you once made when we slept together. I push your wheelchair and straighten my back, not letting it sink into a stoop before it's time. I feel my muscles tighten up the incline and wish you could feel it too from your glued position. You need me now to move in any direction, up and down and around corners, without bumping into things like winter boots thrown casually on the floor. I take the lead, pulling you out of yourself and into the world I inhabit. You visit me from time to time like you used to do, when you did the dishes and the counters always needed wiping. This evening is better than this morning when you berated yourself for growing old. What can I do, you asked, pleading with yourself. I whispered, nothing. Evenings we meet on the sofa and talk about a story in the New York Times or a scene from the evening news. We are same-minded again. The world is spinning crazily out of its orbit. We shake our heads from side to side in rhythmic disbelief. I reach for your still hand, cover it with mine and keep it there.
We are talking with Madeline Kuhn in her memoirs, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Madeline Kuhn, former three-term governor of Vermont, also served as deputy secretary of education and ambassador to Switzerland under President Bill Clinton. Her memoir is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you would like to join our conversation, you have a comment or a question for Governor Kuhn, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We talked a little bit about downsizing and there are items that you have that would be of interest outside of the family. And you write this about your inaugural ball gowns. I have to save them. They belong to history. This is what the first female governor of Vermont wore at her inaugural ball. I consider calling the Vermont Historical Society to ask if they will store them. The thought of the gowns displayed on mannequins who look perpetually young is pleasing. The gowns will continue to be who I once was. But you never followed up with that. What a great idea.
I'll do it right after this program.
So was that difficult for you going through your things and thinking, what do I keep? What do I give to the kids? What do I save for historical value?
Yes, it is difficult. And as I'm talking to other people, that's one of the chapters they really identify with. I think most people, as they grow older, have to downsize, and it's hard, even if you want to do it, know you have to do it. It's not only a physical challenge, all those boxes that you have to lug around and put together and fill up and figure out where to carry them to, but it's also an emotional process because all the chapters of your life kind of identified with things, you know, the first dishes that you bought. And in my era, you know, couples, and maybe they still do that, choose the kind of dinnerware they're going to live with for the next 50 or 60 years. So the best part is when your children want something, because then you can say it stayed in the family. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, a rug that my mother had that was called a Persian rug. My son wanted, and every time I go to his house, I see it there, and I'm happy to see it there. That's some things your children don't want, but are willing to store if they have the room, like two silver tea sets that I have, one from my aunt and one from my mother. And nobody wants to polish those tea sets anymore. Now they're pretty black, but they're stored at, again, my son's house. But I couldn't just give them away because there was too much sentiment attached to them, though they're of absolutely no use where they are, which is too bad. We have neither the time nor the patience nor the servants who could have done that.
Yeah. So what advice do you give people who are downsizing?
Well, start early, I guess. Try not to accumulate everything to begin with. One of my daughters-in-law goes to Goodwill quite regularly now, so she doesn't accumulate all these piles of things. And also, get help. You know, have your children involved. And also, at the end, you just have to be ruthless.
All right. So you founded Emerge Vermont. Tell us about that organization.
Well, Emerge Vermont was founded 5 years ago, and it's part of a national organization. I don't know exactly how many states participate, but it must be in the 20s. And what we do is we recruit and train women to run for office. And we don't raise money. We develop skills. And it's very effective because this has been a banner year when so many women have been elected with various backgrounds and talents and skills. And Emerge, the national Emerge, and Emerge in all these different states have been a huge factor. Because, we, for example, we train people in public speaking. Turns out the public speaking is the most frightening thing about being a public person. And you can get over it with practice. And that's what we do. So I've been encouraging women to run for office ever since I was first elected to the Vermont legislature. And it's been a awfully slow process. Mm-hmm. And this year, wow, it sort of exploded all at once. And I guess people really feel inspired that they have to be in the game. They have to have a seat at the table. That's the most direct way of making change. And so it's not only good for women, it's good for America to have these new voices and new backgrounds be part of the decision-making process.
During your speech at the Women's March in Montpelier, you assured people that the pendulum that swung so fast from President Obama to President Trump will swing back again. What are your thoughts on, as you look at this midterm election and the divisiveness that we have? Do you feel like that pendulum is going to swing anytime soon?
I think it's begun to swing in this past election, as there was a huge voter turnout, bigger than normal for midterm elections. And as I said, so many people, not just women and men, ran and won and really flipped Republican seats. But we've got to continue to be activists, to speak out, to run for office, to help other people run for office. And I think it's a very frightening time in many ways. What is really at stake is democracy. And the Congress has to play its role. And there should be, you know, equal power in the executive, legislative, and judicial. So it's not going to be easy. We can't expect the pendulum to dash back to the other side, but I think it's moving. I think the country has a history of not being in an extreme position for a length of time. So I still believe the pendulum will swing, but we have to work for it. We have to be engaged. We have to speak out, and we have to have courage.
I'm thinking of national politics versus local politics, and it seems to me, at least for our little neck of the woods, even though we have kind of equal in the Cape Cod, we have sort of equal Republicans and Democrats in our state legislature. They seem to work together a whole lot better than they are on the national level. And I'm just wondering if maybe your thoughts on local politics, even maybe not on the state level, running for town councils and city councils, and those are people who make real differences.
Absolutely. They are important. Legislative seats determine, for example, reapportionment and can avoid gerrymandering. So local and state politics are very important. But in the end, the overarching issues, like the question of access to safe and legal abortion, the states will possibly play a bigger role than before if Roe v. Wade gets weakened or even eliminated. So, yeah, local issues are important and are interesting, too. Mm. And in many ways, they're easier for women because they don't have to commute to Washington.
Yeah. Yeah.
But surprisingly, there are not that many women, at least in Vermont. That's where women are still scarce in town and city councils.
Would you like to read another poem for us?
Okay. Do you have a choice?
No, you your choice.
All right. Well, let me...
While you're looking for the poem, I'm just going to mention that you have book signings in Boston tonight at 7 at Trident Books and tomorrow night at 7 at Newtonville Books in Newton. So, and we'll have more information about those signings at our website, capeandislands.org.
Okay, I'll read you the last It's called a love poem. Each night I wheel you to your door with a kiss on your lips. I smile, my love, at you. Generously, I think. You don't know how much I love you, you say. I do, I do. We formed a ritual of waving goodbye as I retreat slowly down the hall. At first I wave with one hand in the air, and then my arms go wild before I turn the corner, as if struck by a storm or signaling for help. We wave in tandem. You are there and I am here. The nurses now know we wave not for them, but for one another, to have and to hold the love we swore to once and forever.
It's lovely. I wonder, before we end our conversation, if you might talk a little bit about love later in life. I think you talked about, you know, meeting John at, you know, getting married in your 70s, and you're wondering, and when your first husband got divorced, like, you know, will I fall in love again? Is that possible? You know, we get to a certain age, but it is possible and it is worth it, right?
Absolutely. And if you're lucky, and it's, you know, I used to say to my husband, we're so lucky, and he said, it wasn't luck. We were destined to meet. But it can happen. And I think you do have to be open to it, and you have to meet the right person. But I never thought it would happen, even though I wished for it, of course. But I had gone to so many things in the 10 years that I was single, alone. I had male friends. I dated here and there, but nothing serious. And it was a great surprise. It was a wonderful surprise. And, you know, in a way, it's easier than when you're younger, because you don't have to worry about the children. They are adults by that time and on their own, and you don't have to worry with the conflicts, so adult children can have problems too, of course, but you're in a way more free to focus on one another.
Exactly. And the book is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Madeline Kunin, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for writing the book.
Well, thank you. It's been a wonderful interview. I've enjoyed it very much.
Also, thanks to Doug Shugarts for production assistance in Boston. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.